his office table. Just then, Mercier, the acting manager, entered. "Lachenel would like to see one of you gentlemen," he said. "He says that his business is urgent and he seems quite upset."
"Who's Lachenel?" asked Richard.
"He's your stud groom."
"What do you mean, my stud groom?"
"Yes, sir," explained Mercier. "There are several grooms at the opera, and Monsieur Lachenel is at the head of them."
"And what does this groom do?"
"He has the chief management of the stable."
"What stable?"
"Why, yours, sir, the stable of the opera."
"Is there a stable at the opera? Upon my word, I didn't know. Where is it?"
"In the cellars, on the rotunda side. It's a very important department. We have 12 horses."
12 horses? And what for, in heaven's name?"
"Why, we want trained horses for the processions in the Juive, the Profeta, and so on. Horses used to the boards. It is the groom's business to teach them. Lachenel is very clever at it. He used to manage Franconi's stables."
"Very well. But what does he want?"
"I don't know. I never saw him in such a state."
"He can come in."
Monsieur Lachenel came in, carrying a riding whip, with which he struck his right boot in an irritable manner.
"Good morning, Monsieur Lachenel," said Richard, somewhat impressed. "To what do we owe the honour of your visit?"
"Mr. Manager, I have come to ask you to get rid of the whole stable."
"What? You want to get rid of our horses?"
"I'm not talking of the horses, but of the stablemen."
"How many stablemen have you, Monsieur Lachenel?"
"Six."
"Six stablemen? That's at least two too many."
"These are places," Mercier interposed, "created and forced upon us by the Under-Secretary for Fine Arts. They are filled by protégés of the government, and, if I may venture to—"
"I don't care a hang for the government," roared Richard. "We don't need more than four stablemen for 12 horses."
11, said the head riding master, correcting him.
12, repeated Richard.
11, repeated Lachenel.
"Oh, the acting manager told me that you had 12 horses."
"I did have 12, but I have only 11 since César was stolen." And Monsieur Lachenel gave himself a great smack on the boot with his whip.
"Has César been stolen?" cried the acting manager. "César, the white horse in the Profeta?"
"There are not two Césars," said the stud groom dryly. "I was 10 years at Franconi's, and I have seen plenty of horses in my time. Well, there are not two Césars, and he's been stolen."
"How?"
"I don't know. Nobody knows. That's why I have come to ask you to sack the whole stable."
"What do your stablemen say?"
"All sorts of nonsense. Some of them accuse the supers. Others pretend that it's the acting manager's doorkeeper."
"My doorkeeper? I'll answer for him as I would for myself," protested Mercier.
"But after all, Monsieur Lachenel," cried Richard, "you must have some idea."
"Yes, I have," Monsieur Lachenel declared. "I have an idea, and I'll tell you what it is. There's no doubt about it in my mind." He walked up to the two managers and whispered, "It's the ghost who did the trick."
Richard gave a jump. "What? You too? You too?"
"How do you mean, I too? Isn't it natural after what I saw?"
"What did you see?"
"I saw, as clearly as I now see you, a black shadow riding a white horse that was as like César as two peas."
"And did you run after them?"
"I did, and I shouted, but they were too fast for me, and disappeared in the darkness of the underground gallery."
Monsieur Richard rose. "That will do, Monsieur Lachenel. You can go. We will lodge a complaint against the ghost." "And sack my stable?"
"No, of course. Good morning."
Monsieur Lachenel bowed and withdrew. Richard foamed at the mouth. "Settle that idiot's account at once, please."
"He is a friend of the government representatives," Mercier ventured to say.
"And he takes his vermouth at Tortoni's with La Grenet, Scholl, and Pertuiset, the lion hunter," added Moncharmin. "We shall have the whole press against us. He'll tell the story of the ghost, and everybody will be laughing at our expense. We may as well be dead as ridiculous."
"All right, say no more about it." At that moment the door opened. It must have been deserted by its usual Cerberus, for Mame Giry entered without ceremony, holding a letter in her hand, and said hurriedly,
"I beg your pardon, excuse me, gentlemen, but I had a letter this morning from the opera ghost. He told me to come to you, that you had something to—"
She did not complete the sentence. She saw Firmin Richard's face, and it was a terrible sight. He seemed ready to burst. He said nothing. He could not speak. But suddenly he acted. First, his left arm seized upon the quaint person of Mame Giry and made her describe so unexpected a semicircle that she uttered a despairing cry. Next, his right foot imprinted its sole on the black taffeta of a skirt which certainly had never before undergone a similar outrage in a similar place. The thing happened so quickly that Mame Giry, when in the passage, was still quite bewildered and seemed not to understand. But suddenly she understood, and the opera rang with her indignant yells, her violent protests and threats. About the same time, Carlotta, who had a small house of her own in the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré, rang for her maid, who brought her letters to her bed. Among them was an anonymous missive, written in red ink, in a hesitating, clumsy hand, which ran, "If you appear tonight, you must be prepared for a great misfortune at the moment when you open your mouth to sing, a misfortune worse than death." The letter took away Carlotta's appetite for breakfast. She pushed back her chocolate, sat up in bed, and thought hard. It was not the first letter of the kind which she had received, but she never had one couched in such threatening terms. She thought herself at the time the victim of a thousand jealous attempts, and went about saying that she had a secret enemy who had sworn to ruin her. She pretended that a wicked plot was being hatched against her, a cabal which would come to a head one of those days. But she added that she was not the woman to be intimidated. The truth is that, if there was a cabal, it was led by Carlotta herself against poor Christine, who had no suspicion of it. Carlotta had never forgiven Christine for the triumph which she had achieved when taking her place at a moment's notice. When Carlotta heard of the astounding reception bestowed upon her understudy, she was at once cured of an incipient attack of bronchitis and a bad fit of sulking against the management, and lost the slightest inclination to shirk her duties. From that time she worked with all her might to smother her rival, enlisting the services of influential friends to persuade the managers not to give Christine an opportunity for a fresh triumph. Certain newspapers which had begun to extol the talent of Christine now interested themselves only in the fame of Carlotta. Lastly, in the theatre itself, the celebrated but heartless and soulless diva made the most scandalous remarks about Christine and tried to cause her endless minor unpleasantnesses. When Carlotta had finished thinking over the threat contained in the strange letter, she got up. "We shall see," she said, adding a few oaths in her native Spanish with a very determined air. The first thing she saw when looking out of her window was a hearse. She was very superstitious, and the hearse and the letter convinced her that she was running the most serious dangers that evening. She collected all her supporters, told them that she was threatened at that evening's performance with a plot organized by Christine Daae, and declared that they must play a trick upon that chit by filling the house with her, Carlotta's, admirers. She had no lack of them, did she? She relied upon them to hold themselves prepared for any eventuality and to silence the adversaries if, as she feared, they created a disturbance. Monsieur Richard's private secretary called to ask after the diva's health, and returned with the assurance that she was perfectly well and that, were she dying, she would sing the part of Margarita that evening. The secretary urged her, in his chief's name, to commit no imprudence, to stay at home all day, and to be careful of draughts. And Carlotta could not help, after he had gone, comparing his unusual and unexpected advice with the threats contained in the letter. It was 5 o'clock when the post brought a second anonymous letter in the same hand as the first. It was short and said simply, "You have a bad cold. If you are wise, you will see that it is madness to try to sing tonight." Carlotta sneered, shrugged her handsome shoulders, and sang 2 or 3 notes to reassure herself. Her friends were faithful to their promise. They were all at the opera that night, but looked round in vain for the fierce conspirators whom they were instructed to suppress. The only unusual thing was the presence of Monsieur Richard and Monsieur Moncharmin in Box 5. Carlotta's friends thought that, perhaps, the managers had wind on their wide of the proposed disturbance, and that they had determined to be in the house so as to stop it then and there. But this was unjustifiable supposition, as the reader knows. Monsieur Richard and Monsieur Moncharmin were thinking of nothing but their ghost. "Vain, in vain do I call through my vigil weary on creation and its Lord. Never reply will break the silence dreary, no sign, no single word." The famous baritone Carolus Fonta had hardly finished Dr. Faust's first appeal to the powers of darkness when Monsieur Firmin Richard, who was sitting in the ghost's own chair, the front chair on the right, leaned over to his partner and asked him chaffingly, "Well, has the ghost whispered a word in your ear yet?"
"Wait, don't be in such a hurry," replied Monsieur Armand Moncharmin in the same gay tone. "The performance has only begun, and you know that the ghost does not usually come until the middle of the first act."
The first act passed without incident, which did not surprise Carlotta's friends, because Margarita does not sing in this act. As for the managers, they looked at each other when the curtain fell.
"That's one," said Moncharmin.
"Yes, the ghost is late," said Firmin Richard.
"It's not a bad house," said Moncharmin, "for a house with a curse on it."
Monsieur Richard smiled and pointed to a fat, rather vulgar woman dressed in black, sitting in a stall in the middle of the auditorium with a man in a broadcloth frock coat on either side of her.
"Who on earth are those?" asked Moncharmin.
"Those, my dear fellow, are my concierge, her husband, and her brother."
"Did you give them their tickets?"
"I did. My concierge had never been to the opera. This is the first time, and as she is now going to come every night, I wanted her to have a good seat before spending her time showing other people to theirs." Moncharmin asked what he meant, and Richard answered that he had persuaded his concierge, in whom he had the greatest confidence, to come and take Mame Giry's place. Yes, he would like to see if, with that woman instead of the old lunatic, Box 5 would continue to astonish the natives.
"By the way," said Moncharmin, "you know that Mother Giry is going to lodge a complaint against you."
"With whom? The ghost?"
"The ghost."
Moncharmin had almost forgotten him. However, that mysterious person did nothing to bring himself to the memory of the managers, and they were just saying so to each other for the second time when the door of the box suddenly opened to admit the startled stage manager.
"What's the matter?" they both asked, amazed at seeing him there at such a time.
"It seems there's a plot got up by Christine Daae's friends against Carlotta. Carlotta's furious."
"What on earth?" said Richard, knitting his brows. But the curtain rose on the kermesse scene, and Richard made a sign to the stage manager to go away. When the two were alone again, Moncharmin leaned over to Richard.
"Then Daae has friends?" he asked.
"Yes, she has."
"Whom?"
Richard glanced across at a box on the grand tier containing no one but two men.
"The Comte de Chagny?"
"Yes. He spoke to me in her favour with such warmth that, if I had not known him to be Sorelli's friend..."
"Really? Really?" said Moncharmin. "And who is that pale young man beside him?"
"That's his brother, the Viscount."
"He ought to be in his bed. He looks ill."
The stage rang with gay song. "Red or white liquor, coarse or fine, what can it matter so we have wine?" Students, citizens, soldiers, girls, and matrons whirled light-heartedly before the inn with the figure of Bacchus for a sign. Sibel made her entrance. Christine Daae looked charming in her boy's clothes, and Carlotta's partisans expected to hear her greeted with an ovation which would have enlightened them as to the intentions of her friends. But nothing happened. On the other hand, when Margarita crossed the stage and sang the only two lines allotted her in this second act, "No, my lord, not a lady am I, nor yet a beauty, and do not need an arm to help me on my way," Carlotta was received with enthusiastic applause. It was so unexpected and so uncalled for that those who knew nothing about the rumours looked at one another and asked what was happening. And this act also was finished without incident. Then everybody said, "Of course, it will be during the next act." Some, who seemed to be better informed than the rest, declared that the row would begin with the ballad of the King of Thule, and rushed to the subscriber's entrance to warn Carlotta. The managers left the box during the entr'acte to find out more about the cabal of which the stage manager had spoken, but they soon returned to their seats, shrugging their shoulders and treating the whole affair as silly. The first thing they saw, on entering the box, was a box of English sweets on the little shelf of the ledge. Who had put it there? They asked the box-keepers, but none of them knew. Then they went back to the shelf and, next to the box of sweets, found an opera glass. They looked at each other. They had no inclination to laugh. All that Madame Giry had told them returned to their memory. And then, they seemed to feel a curious sort of draught around them. They sat down in silence. The scene represented Margarita's garden. "Gentle flowers in the dew, be message from me."
As she sang these first two lines with her bunch of roses and lilacs in her hand, Christine, raising her head, saw the Vicomte de Chagny in his box, and from that moment her voice seemed less sure, less crystal clear than usual. Something seemed to deaden and dull her singing. "What a queer girl she is," said one of Carlotta's friends in the stalls, almost aloud. "The other day she was divine, and tonight she's simply bleating. She has no experience, no training." "Gentle flowers, lie ye there, and tell her from me." The Viscount put his head under his hands and wept. The Count, behind him, viciously gnawed his moustache, shrugged his shoulders, and frowned. For him, usually so cold and correct, to betray his inner feelings like that by outward signs, the Count must be very angry. He was. He had seen his brother return from a rapid and mysterious journey in an alarming state of health. The explanation that followed was unsatisfactory, and the Count asked Christine Daae for an appointment. She had the audacity to reply that she could not see either him or his brother. "Would she but deign to hear me, and with one smile to cheer me?" "The little baggage," growled the Count. And he wondered what she wanted, what she was hoping for. She was a virtuous girl. She was said to have no friend, no protector of any sort. That angel from the north must be very artful. Raoul, behind the curtain of his hands that veiled his boyish tears, thought only of the letter which he received on his return to Paris, where Christine, fleeing from Perrault like a thief in the night, had arrived before him. "My dear little playfellow, you must have the courage not to see me again, not to speak of me again. If you love me just a little, do this for me who will never forget you, my dear Raoul. My life depends upon it. Your life depends upon it. Your little Christine." Thunders of applause. Carlotta made her entrance. "I wish I could but know who was he that addressed me, if he was noble, or at least what his name is." When Margarita had finishing the ballad of the King of Thule, she was loudly cheered, and again when she came to the end of the jewel song. "Ah, the joy of past compare, these jewels bright to wear." Thenceforth, certain of herself, certain of her friends in the house, certain of her voice and her success, fearing nothing, Carlotta flung herself into her part without restraint of modesty. She was no longer Margarita, she was Carmen. She was applauded all the more, and her debut with Faust seemed about to bring her a new success, when suddenly a terrible thing happened. Faust had knelt on one knee. "Let me gaze on the form below me, while from yonder ether blue, look how the star of eve, bright and tender, lingers o'er me, to love thy beauty too." And Margarita replied, "Oh, how strange, like a spell does the evening bind me, and a deep, languid charm I feel without alarm, with its melody enwind me, and all my heart subdue." At that moment, at that identical moment, the terrible thing happened. Carlotta croaked like a toad.
"Quack!"
There was consternation on Carlotta's face, and consternation on the faces of all the audience. The two managers in their box could not suppress an exclamation of horror. Everyone felt that the thing was not natural, that there was witchcraft behind it. That toad smelt of brimstone. Poor, wretched, despairing, crushed Carlotta. The uproar in the house was indescribable. If the thing had happened to anyone but Carlotta, she would have been hooted. But everybody knew how perfect an instrument her voice was, and there was no display of anger, but only of horror and dismay, the sort of dismay which men would have felt if they had witnessed the catastrophe that broke the arms of the Venus de Milo, and even then they would have seen and understood. But here that toad was incomprehensible, so much so that after some seconds spent in asking herself if she had really heard that note, that sound, that infernal noise issue from her throat, she tried to persuade herself that it was not so, that she was the victim of an illusion of the ear, and not of an act of treachery on the part of her voice. Meanwhile, in Box 5, Moncharmin and Richard had turned very pale. This extraordinary and inexplicable incident filled them with a dread which was the more mysterious, inasmuch as for some little while they had fallen within the direct influence of the ghost. They had felt his breath. Moncharmin's hair stood on end. Richard wiped the perspiration from his forehead. Yes, the ghost was there, around them, behind them, beside them. They felt his presence without seeing him. They heard his breath, close, close, close to them. They were sure that there were three people in the box. They trembled. They thought of running away. They dared not. They dared not make a movement or exchange a word that would have told the ghost that they knew that he was there. What was going to happen? This happened.
Quack!
Their joint exclamation of horror was heard all over the house. They felt that they were smarting under the ghost's attacks. Leaning over the ledge of their box, they stared at Carlotta as though they did not recognize her. That infernal girl must have given the signal for some catastrophe. Ah, they were waiting for the catastrophe. The ghost had told them it would come. The house had a curse upon it. The two managers gasped and panted under the weight of the catastrophe. Richard's stifled voice was heard calling to Carlotta,
"Well, go on."
No, Carlotta did not go on. Bravely, heroically, she started afresh on the fatal line at the end of which the toad had appeared. An awful silence succeeded the uproar. Carlotta's voice alone once more filled the resounding house. "I feel without alarm." The audience also felt, but not without alarm. "I feel without alarm. I feel without alarm.
Quack!"
With its melody enwind me.
"Quack!"
And all my heart
sub-quack!
The toad also had started afresh. The house broke into a wild tumult. The two managers collapsed in their chairs and dared not even turn round. They had not the strength. The ghost was chuckling behind their backs. And, at last, they distinctly heard his voice in their right ears, the impossible voice, the mouthless voice, saying, "She is singing tonight to bring the chandelier down." With one accord they raised their eyes to the ceiling and uttered a terrible cry. The chandelier, the immense mass of the chandelier, was slipping down, coming toward them at the call of that fiendish voice. Released from its hook, it plunged from the ceiling and came smashing into the middle of the stalls amid a thousand shouts of terror. A wild rush for the doors followed. The papers of the day state that there were numbers wounded and one killed. The chandelier had crashed down upon the head of the wretched woman who had come to the opera for the first time in her life, the one whom Monsieur Richard had appointed to succeed Mame Giry, the ghost's boxkeeper, in her functions. She died on the spot, and the next morning a newspaper appeared with this heading, 200 kilos on the head of a concierge." That was her sole epitaph. Chapter 8. The Mysterious Brougham. That tragic evening was bad for everybody. Carlotta fell ill. As for Christine Daae, she disappeared after the performance. A fortnight elapsed, during which she was seen neither at the opera nor outside. Raoul, of course, was the first to be astonished at the prima donna's absence. He wrote to her at Madame Valeria's flat and received no reply. His grief increased, and he ended by being seriously alarmed at never seeing her name on the program. Faust was played without her. One afternoon he went to the manager's office to ask the reason of Christine's disappearance. He found them both looking extremely worried. Their own friends did not recognize them. They had lost all their gaiety and spirits. They were seen crossing the stage with hanging heads, careworn brows, pale cheeks, as though pursued by some abominable thought or a prey to some persistent sport of fate. The fall of the chandelier had involved them in no little responsibility, but it was difficult to make them speak about it. The inquest had ended in a verdict of accidental death, caused by the wear and tear of the chains by which the chandelier was hung from the ceiling. But it was the duty of both the old and the new managers to have discovered this wear and tear and to have remedied it in time. And I feel bound to say that Monsieur Richard and Moncharmin at this time appeared so changed, so absent-minded, so mysterious, so incomprehensible, that many of the subscribers thought that some event even more horrible than the fall of the chandelier must have affected their state of mind. In their daily intercourse they showed themselves very impatient, except with Madame Giry, who had been reinstated in her functions. And their reception of the Vicomte de Chagny, when he came to ask about Christine, was anything but cordial. They merely told him that she was taking a holiday. He asked how long the holiday was for, and they replied curtly that it was for an unlimited period, as Mademoiselle Daae had requested a leave of absence for reasons of health. "Well, then she is ill," he cried. "What is the matter with her?" "We don't know." "Didn't you send the doctor of the opera to see her?" "No. She did not ask for him, and, as we trust her, we took her word." Raoul left the building a prey to the gloomiest thoughts. He resolved, come what might, to go and inquire of Mama Valerius. He remembered the strong phrases in Christine's letter forbidding him to make any attempt to see her. But what he had seen at Perrault, what he had heard behind the dressing-room door, his conversation with Christine at the edge of the moor, made him suspect some machination which, devilish though it might be, was none the less human. The girl's highly strung imagination, her affectionate and credulous mind, the primitive education which had surrounded her childhood with a circle of legends, the constant brooding over her dead father, and, above all, the state of sublime ecstasy into which music threw her from the moment that this art was made manifest to her in certain exceptional conditions, as in the churchyard at Perrault. All this seemed to him to constitute a moral ground only too favourable for the malevolent designs of some mysterious and unscrupulous person. Of whom was Christine Daae the victim? This was the very reasonable question which Raoul put to himself as he hurried off to Mama Valerius. He trembled as he rang at a little flat in the Rue Notre-Dame des Victoires. The door was opened by the maid whom he had seen coming out of Christine's dressing-room one evening. He asked if he could speak to Madame Valerius. He was told that she was ill in bed and was not receiving visitors. "Take in my card, please," he said. The maid soon returned and showed him into a small and scantily furnished drawing-room, in which portraits of Professor Valerius and old Daae hung on opposite walls. "Madame begs Monsieur le Vicomte to excuse her," said the servant. "She can only see him in her bedroom because she can no longer stand on her poor legs." 5 minutes later, Raoul was ushered into an ill-lit room where he at once recognized the good, kind face of Christine's benefactress in the semi-darkness of an alcove. Mama Valeria's hair was now quite white, but her eyes had grown no older. Never, on the contrary, had their expression been so bright, so pure, so childlike. "Monsieur de Chagny," she cried gaily, putting out both her hands to her visitor. "Ah, it's heaven that sends you here. We can talk of her." This last sentence sounded very gloomily in the young man's ears. He at once asked, "Madame, where is Christine?" And the old lady replied calmly, "She is with her good genius." "What good genius?" exclaimed poor Raoul. "Why, the angel of music." The Viscount dropped into a chair. Really? Christine was with the angel of music? And there lay Mama Valerius in bed, smiling to him and putting her finger to her lips to warn him to be silent. And she added, "You must not tell anyone." "You can rely on me," said Raoul. He hardly knew what he was saying, for his ideas about Christine, already greatly confused, were becoming more and more entangled. And it seemed as if everything was beginning to turn around him, around the room, around that extraordinary good lady with the white hair and forget-me-not eyes. I know I can," she said, with a happy laugh. "But why don't you come near me, as you used to do when you were a little boy? Give me your hands, as when you brought me the story of little Lottie, which Daddy Daae had told you. I am very fond of you, Monsieur Raoul, you know, and so is Christine, too." "She is fond of me," sighed the young man. He found a difficulty in collecting his thoughts and bringing them to bear on Mama Valerius's good genius, on the angel of music of whom Christine had spoken to him so strangely, on the death's head which he had seen in a sort of nightmare on the high altar at Perrault, and also on the opera ghost, whose fame had come to his ears one evening when he was standing behind the scenes, within hearing of a group of scene-shifters who were repeating the ghastly description which the hanged man, Joseph Bouquet, had given of the ghost before his mysterious death. He asked in a low voice, "What makes you think that Christine is fond of me, madame?" "She used to speak of you every day." "Really? And what did she tell you?" "She told me that you had made her a proposal." And the good old lady began laughing wholeheartedly. Raoul sprang from his chair, flushing to the temples, suffering agonies. "What's this? Where are you going? Sit down again at once, will you? Do you think I will let you go like that? If you're angry with me for laughing, I beg your pardon. After all, what has happened isn't your fault. Didn't you know? Did you think that Christine was free?" "Is Christine engaged to be married?" the wretched Raoul asked in a choking voice. "Why, no. Why, no, you know as well as I do that Christine couldn't marry, even if she wanted to.
But I don't know anything about it. And why can't Christine marry?
Because of the Angel of Music, of course.
I don't follow.
Yes, he forbids her to.
He forbids her? The Angel of Music forbids her to marry?
Oh, he forbids her, without forbidding her. It's like this. He tells her that if she got married, she would never hear him again, that's all, and that he would go away forever. So you understand, she can't let the Angel of Music go, it's quite natural.
Yes, yes, echoed Raoul submissively, it's quite natural.
Besides, I thought Christine had told you all that when she met you at Perrault, where she went with her good genius.
Oh, she went to Perrault with her good genius, did she?
Well, that is to say, he arranged to meet her down there in Perrault churchyard at Daae's grave. He promised to play her the Resurrection of Lazarus on her father's violin.
Raoul de Chagny rose and, with a very authoritative air, pronounced these peremptory words. Madame, you will have the goodness to tell me where that genius lives. The old lady did not seem surprised at this indiscreet command. She raised her eyes and said,
In heaven.
Such simplicity baffled him. He did not know what to say in the presence of this candid and perfect faith in a genius who came down nightly from heaven to haunt the dressing rooms at the opera. He now realized the possible state of mind of a girl brought up between a superstitious fiddler and a visionary old lady, and he shuddered when he thought of the consequences of it all.
"Is Christine still a good girl?" he asked suddenly, in spite of himself.
"I swear it, as I hope to be saved," exclaimed the old woman, who this time seemed to be incensed. "And if you doubt it, sir, I don't know what you are here for."
Raoul tore at his gloves.
"How long has she known this genius?"
"About 3 months."
"Yes, it's quite 3 months since he began to give her lessons."
The Viscount threw up his arms with a gesture of despair.
"The genius gives her lessons, and where, pray?"
"Now that she has gone away with him, I can't say. But up to a fortnight ago, it was in Christine's dressing room. It would be impossible in this little flat. The whole house would hear them. Whereas, at the opera, at 8 o'clock in the morning, there is no one about, you see."
"Yes, I see," cried the Viscount. And he hurriedly took leave of Madame Valerius, who asked herself if the young nobleman was not a little off his head. He walked home to his brother's house in a pitiful state. He could have struck himself, banged his head against the walls. To think that he had believed in her innocence, in her purity. The Angel of Music. He knew him now. He saw him. It was beyond a doubt some unspeakable tenor, a good-looking jackanapes who mouthed and simpered as he sang. He thought himself as absurd and as wretched as could be. Oh, what a miserable little insignificant silly young man was Monsieur le Vicomte de Chagny, thought Raoul furiously. And she, what a bold and damnable sly creature. His brother was waiting for him, and Raoul fell into his arms like a child. The Count consoled him, without asking for explanations, and Raoul would certainly have long hesitated before telling him the story of the Angel of Music. His brother suggested taking him out to dinner. Overcome as he was with despair, Raoul would probably have refused any invitation that evening if the Count had not, as an inducement, told him that the lady of his thoughts had been seen, the night before, in the company of the other sex in the Bois. At first, the Viscount refused to believe, but he received such exact details that he ceased protesting. She had been seen, it appeared, driving in a brougham with the window down. She seemed to be slowly taking in the icy night air. There was a glorious moon shining. She was recognized beyond a doubt. As for her companion, only his shadowy outline was distinguished leaning back in the dark. The carriage was going at a walking pace in a lonely drive behind the grandstand at Longchamp. Raoul dressed in frantic haste, prepared to forget his distress by flinging himself, as people say, into the vortex of pleasure. Alas, he was a very sorry guest and, leaving his brother early, found himself by 10 o'clock in the evening in a cab behind the Longchamp racecourse. It was bitterly cold. The road seemed deserted and very bright under the moonlight. He told the driver to wait for him patiently at the corner of a near turning, and, hiding himself as well as he could, stood stamping his feet to keep warm.
He had been indulging in this healthy exercise for half an hour or so, when a carriage turned the corner of the road and came quietly in his direction at a walking pace. As it approached, he saw that a woman was leaning her head from the window, and suddenly the moon shed a pale gleam over her features. "Christine!" The sacred name of his love had sprung from his heart and his lips. He could not keep it back. He would have given anything to withdraw it, for that name, proclaimed in the stillness of the night, had acted as though it were the preconcerted signal for a furious rush on the part of the whole turnout, which dashed past him before he could put into execution his plan of leaping at the horses' heads. The carriage window had been closed, and the girl's face had disappeared, and the brougham, behind which he was now running, was no more than a black spot on the white road. He called out again, "Christine!" No reply, and he stopped in the midst of the silence. With a lackluster eye he stared down that cold, desolate road and into the pale, dead night. Nothing was colder than his heart, nothing half so dead. He had loved an angel, and now he despised a woman. "Raoul, how that little fairy of the north has trifled with you! Was it really necessary to have so fresh and young a face, a forehead so shy and always ready to cover itself with the pink blush of modesty in order to pass in the lonely night in a carriage and pair, accompanied by a mysterious lover? Surely there should be some limit to hypocrisy and lying?" She had passed without answering his cry, and he was thinking of dying, and he was 20 years old. His valet found him in the morning sitting on his bed. He had not undressed, and the servant feared at the sight of his face that some disaster had occurred. Raoul snatched his letters from the man's hands. He had recognized Christine's paper and handwriting. She said, "Dear, go to the masked ball at the opera on the night after tomorrow. At 12 o'clock, be in the little room behind the chimney place of the big crush room. Stand near the door that leads to the rotunda. Don't mention this appointment to anyone on earth. Wear a white domino and be carefully masked. As you love me, do not let yourself be recognized. Christine." Chapter 9. At the Masked Ball. The envelope was covered with mud and unstamped. It bore the words, "To be handed to Monsieur le Vicomte Raoul de Chagny," with the address in pencil. It must have been flung out in the hope that a passer-by would pick up the note and deliver it, which was what happened. The note had been picked up on the pavement of the Place de l'Opéra. Raoul read it over again with fevered eyes. No more was needed to revive his hope. The somber picture which he had for a moment imagined of a Christine forgetting her duty to herself made way for his original conception of an unfortunate, innocent child, the victim of imprudence and exaggerated sensibility. To what extent, at this time, was she really a victim? Whose prisoner was she? Into what whirlpool had she been dragged? He asked himself these questions with a cruel anguish, but even this pain seemed endurable beside the frenzy into which he was thrown at the thought of a lying and deceitful Christine. What had happened? What influence had she undergone? What monster had carried her off, and by what means? By what means indeed but that of music? He knew Christine's story. After her father's death, she acquired a distaste of everything in life, including her art. She went through the conservatoire like a poor, soulless singing machine. And, suddenly, she awoke as though through the intervention of a god. The angel of music appeared upon the scene. She sang Margarita in Faust and triumphed. The angel of music. For 3 months, the angel of music had been giving Christine lessons. Ah, he was a punctual singing master. And now he was taking her for drives in the Bois. Raoul's fingers clutched at his flesh above his jealous heart. In his inexperience, he now asked himself with terror what game the girl was playing. Up to what point could an opera singer make a fool of a good-natured young man quite new to love? Oh, misery! Thus did Raoul's thoughts fly from one extreme to the other. He no longer knew whether to pity Christine or curse her, and he pitied and cursed her turn and turn about. At all events, he bought a white domino. The hour of the appointment came at last. With his face in a mask trimmed with long, thick lace, looking like a Pierrot in his white wrap, the Viscount thought himself very ridiculous. Men of the world do not go to the opera ball in fancy dress. It was absurd. One thought, however, consoled the Viscount. He would certainly never be recognized. This ball was an exceptional affair, given some time before Shrovetide in honour of the anniversary of the birth of a famous draughtsman, and it was expected to be much gayer, noisier, more bohemian than the ordinary masked ball. Numbers of artists had arranged to go, accompanied by a whole cohort of models and pupils, who, by midnight, began to create a tremendous din. Raoul climbed the grand staircase at 12:05, did not linger to look at the motley dresses displayed all the way up the marble steps, one of the richest settings in the world, allowed no facetious mask to draw him into a war of wits, replied to no jests, and shook off the bold familiarity of a number of couples who had already become a trifle too gay. Crossing the crush-room and escaping from a mad whirl of dancers in which he was caught for a moment, he at last entered the room mentioned in Christine's letter. He found it crammed, for this small space was the point where all those who were going to supper in the rotunda crossed those who were returning from taking a glass of champagne. The fun, here, waxed fast and furious. Raoul leaned against the doorpost and waited. He did not wait long. A black domino passed and gave a quick squeeze to the tips of his fingers. He understood that it was she and followed her. "Is that you, Christine?" he asked, between his teeth. The black domino turned round promptly and raised her finger to her lips, no doubt to warn him not to mention her name again. Raoul continued to follow her in silence. He was afraid of losing her after meeting her again in such strange circumstances. His grudge against her was gone. He no longer doubted that she had nothing to reproach herself with, however peculiar and inexplicable her conduct might seem. He was ready to make any display of clemency, forgiveness, or cowardice. He was in love, and, no doubt, he would soon receive a very natural explanation of her curious absence. The black domino turned back from time to time to see if the white domino was still following. As Raoul once more passed through the great crush-room, this time in the wake of his guide, he could not help noticing a group crowding round a person whose disguise, eccentric air, and gruesome appearance were causing a sensation. It was a man dressed all in scarlet, with a huge hat and feathers on the top of a wonderful death's head. From his shoulders hung an immense red velvet cloak, which trailed along the floor like a king's train. And on this cloak was embroidered in gold letters, which everyone read and repeated aloud, "Don't touch me. I am Red Death stalking abroad." Then one, greatly daring, did try to touch him. But a skeleton hand shot out of a crimson sleeve and violently seized the rash one's wrist. And he, feeling the clutch of the knuckle-bones, the furious grasp of death, uttered a cry of pain and terror. When Red Death released him at last, he ran away like a very madman, pursued by the jeers of the bystanders. It was at this moment that Raoul passed in front of the funereal masquerader, who had just happened to turn in his direction, and he nearly exclaimed, "The death's head of Perrault Guirec!" He had recognized him. He wanted to dart forward, forgetting Christine, but the black domino, who also seemed a prey to some strange excitement, caught him by the arm and dragged him from the crush-room, far from the mad crowd through which Red Death was stalking. The black domino kept on turning back and, apparently, on two occasions, saw something that startled her, for she hurried her pace and Raoul's as though they were being pursued. They went up two floors. Here the stairs and corridors were almost deserted. The black domino opened the door of a private box and beckoned to the white domino to follow her. Then Christine, whom he recognized by the sound of her voice, closed the door behind them and warned him in a whisper to remain at the back of the box, and on no account to show himself. Raoul took off his mask. Christine kept hers on. And, when Raoul was about to ask her to remove it, he was surprised to see her put her ear to the partition and listen eagerly for a sound outside. Then she opened the door ajar, looked out into the corridor, and, in a low voice, said, "He must have gone up higher." Suddenly she exclaimed, "He is coming down again." She tried to close the door, but Raoul prevented her, for he had seen on the top step of the staircase that led to the floor above a red foot, followed by another. And slowly, majestically, the whole scarlet dress of Red Death met his eyes, and he once more saw the death's head of Perrault Guirec. "It's he!" he exclaimed. "This time he shall not escape me." But Christine had slammed the door at the moment when Raoul was on the point of rushing out. He tried to push her aside. "Whom do you mean by he?" she asked in a changed voice. "Who shall not escape you?" Raoul tried to overcome the girl's resistance by force, but she repelled him with a strength which he would not have suspected in her. He understood, or thought he understood, and at once lost his temper. "Who?" he repeated angrily. "Why, he, the man who hides behind that hideous mask of death, the evil genius of the churchyard at Perrault, Red Death. In a word, madam, your friend, your angel of music. But I shall snatch off his mask, as I shall snatch off my own, and, this time, we shall look each other in the face, he and I, with no veil and no lies between us, and I shall know whom you love and who loves you." He burst into a mad laugh, while Christine gave a disconsolate moan behind her velvet mask. With a tragic gesture, she flung out her two arms, which fixed a barrier of white flesh against the door. "In the name of our love, Raoul, you shall not pass." He stopped. What had she said? In the name of their love? Never before had she confessed that she loved him. And yet she had had opportunities enough. Oh, pooh! Her only object was to gain a few seconds. She wished to give the Red Death time to escape. And, in accents of childish hatred, he said, "You lie, madam, for you do not love me, and you have never loved me. What a poor fellow I must be to let you mock and flout me as you have done. Why did you give me every reason for hope at Perrault? For honest hope, madam. For I am an honest man, and I believed you to be an honest woman, when your only intention was to deceive me. Alas, you have deceived us all. You have taken a shameful advantage of the candid affection of your benefactress herself, who continues to believe in your sincerity while you go about the opera ball with Red Death. I despise you." And he burst into tears. She allowed him to insult her. She thought of but one thing, to keep him from leaving the box. "You will beg my pardon one day for all those ugly words, Raoul, and when you do, I shall forgive you." He shook his head. "No, no, you have driven me mad. When I think that I had only one object in life, to give my name to an opera wench."
"Raoul, how can you?"
"I shall die of shame."
"No, dear, live,"
said Christine's grave and changed voice, "and
goodbye. Goodbye, Raoul."
The boy stepped forward, staggering as he went. He risked one more sarcasm. "Oh, you must let me come and applaud you from time to time."
"I shall never sing again, Raoul."
"Really?" he replied, still more satirically. "So he is taking you off the stage. I congratulate you. But we shall meet in the Bois one of these evenings."
"Not in the Bois nor anywhere, Raoul. You shall not see me again."
"May one ask at least to what darkness you are returning? For what hell are you leaving, mysterious lady, or for what paradise?"
"I came to tell you, dear, but I can't tell you now. You would not believe me. You have lost faith in me, Raoul. It is finished."
She spoke in such a despairing voice that the lad began to feel remorse for his cruelty. "But look here," he cried, "can't you tell me what all this means? You are free. There is no one to interfere with you. You go about Paris. You put on a domino to come to the ball. Why do you not go home? What have you been doing this past fortnight? What is this tale about the angel of music which you have been telling Mama Valerius? Someone may have taken you in, played upon your innocence. I was a witness of it myself at Perrault. But you know what to believe now. You seem to me quite sensible, Christine. You know what you are doing. And meanwhile Mama Valerius lies waiting for you at home and appealing to your good genius. Explain yourself, Christine, I beg of you. Anyone might have been deceived as I was. What is this farce?" Christine simply took off her mask and said, "Dear, it is a tragedy." Raoul now saw her face and could not restrain an exclamation of surprise and terror. The fresh complexion of former days was gone. A mortal pallor covered those features which he had known so charming and so gentle, and sorrow had furrowed them with pitiless lines and traced dark and unspeakably sad shadows under her eyes. "My dearest, my dearest," he moaned, holding out his arms, "you promised to forgive me."
"Perhaps.
Some day, perhaps," she said, resuming her mask, and she went away, forbidding him with a gesture to follow her. He tried to disobey her, but she turned round and repeated her gesture of farewell with such authority that he dared not move a step. He watched her till she was out of sight. Then he also went down among the crowd, hardly knowing what he was doing, with throbbing temples and an aching heart. And, as he crossed the dancing floor, he asked if anybody had seen Red Death. Yes, everyone had seen Red Death. But Raoul could not find him. And at 2 o'clock in the morning he turned down the passage behind the scenes that led to Christine Daae's dressing room. His footsteps took him to that room where he had first known suffering. He tapped at the door. There was no answer. He entered, as he had entered when he looked everywhere for the man's voice. The room was empty. A gas jet was burning, turned down low. He saw some writing paper on a little desk. He thought of writing to Christine, but he heard steps in the passage. He had only time to hide in the inner room, which was separated from the dressing room by a curtain. Christine entered, took off her mask with a weary movement and flung it on the table. She sighed and let her pretty head fall into her two hands. What was she thinking of? Of Raoul? No, for Raoul heard her murmur, "Poor Eric." At first he thought he must be mistaken. To begin with, he was persuaded that if anyone was to be pitied, it was he, Raoul. It would have been quite natural if she had said, "Poor Raoul," after what had happened between them. But, shaking her head, she repeated, "Poor Eric." What had this Eric to do with Christine's sighs, and why was she pitying Eric when Raoul was so unhappy? Christine began to write, deliberately, calmly, and so placidly that Raoul, who was still trembling from the effects of the tragedy that separated them, was painfully impressed. "What coolness," he said to himself. She wrote on, filling 2, 3, 4 sheets. Suddenly she raised her head and hid the sheets in her bodice. She seemed to be listening. Raoul also listened. Whence came that strange sound, that distant rhythm? A faint singing seemed to issue from the walls. Yes, it was as though the walls themselves were singing. The song became plainer. The words were now distinguishable. He heard a voice, a very beautiful, very soft, very captivating voice, but for all its softness it remained a male voice. The voice came nearer and nearer. It came through the wall. It approached, and now the voice was in the room, in front of Christine. Christine rose and addressed the voice, as though speaking to someone. "Here I am, Eric," she said. "I am ready, but you are late." Raoul, peeping from behind the curtain, could not believe his eyes, which showed him nothing. Christine's face lit up. A smile of happiness appeared upon her bloodless lips. A smile like that of sick people when they receive the first hope of recovery.
The voice without a body went on singing, and certainly Raoul had never in his life heard anything more absolutely and heroically sweet, more gloriously insidious, more delicate, more powerful, in short, more irresistibly triumphant. He listened to it in a fever, and he now began to understand how Christine Daae was able to appear one evening before the stupefied audience with accents of a beauty hitherto unknown, of a superhuman exaltation, while doubtless still under the influence of the mysterious and invisible master. The voice was singing the wedding night song from Romeo and Juliet. Raoul saw Christine stretch out her arms to the voice, as she had done in Perrault churchyard to the invisible violin playing the resurrection of Lazarus. And nothing could describe the passion with which the voice sang, "Fate links thee to me for ever and a day." The strains went through Raoul's heart. Struggling against the charm that seemed to deprive him of all his will and all his energy, and of almost all his lucidity at the moment when he needed them most, he succeeded in drawing back the curtain that hid him, and he walked to where Christine stood. She herself was moving to the back of the room, the whole wall of which was occupied by a great mirror that reflected her image but not his, for he was just behind her and entirely covered by her. "Fate links thee to me for ever and a day." Christine walked toward her image in the glass, and the image came toward her. The two Christines, the real one and the reflection, ended by touching, and Raoul put out his arms to clasp the two in one embrace. But by a sort of dazzling miracle that sent him staggering, Raoul was suddenly flung back, while an icy blast swept over his face. He saw not two, but four, eight, 20 Christines spinning round him, laughing at him, and fleeing so swiftly that he could not touch one of them. At last everything stood still again, and he saw himself in the glass. But Christine had disappeared. He rushed up to the glass. He struck at the walls. Nobody. And meanwhile the room still echoed with a distant, passionate singing, "Fate links thee to me for ever and a day." Which way? Which way had Christine gone? Which way would she return? Would she return? Alas, had she not declared to him that everything was finished? And was the voice not repeating, "Fate links thee to me for ever and a day"? To me? To whom? Then, worn out, beaten, empty-brained, he sat down on the chair which Christine had just left. Like her, he let his head fall into his hands. When he raised it, the tears were streaming down his young cheeks, real, heavy tears like those which jealous children shed, tears that wept for a sorrow which was in no way fanciful, but which is common to all the lovers on earth, and which he expressed aloud. "Who is this Eric?" he said. Chapter 10. Forget the name of the man's voice. The day after Christine had vanished before his eyes in a sort of dazzlement that still made him doubt the evidence of his senses, Monsieur le Vicomte de Chagny called to inquire at Mama Valerius's. He came upon a charming picture. Christine herself was seated by the bedside of the old lady, who was sitting up against the pillows knitting. The pink and white had returned to the young girl's cheeks. The dark rings round her eyes had disappeared. Raoul no longer recognized the tragic face of the day before. If the veil of melancholy over those adorable features had not still appeared to the young man as the last trace of the weird drama in whose toils that mysterious child was struggling, he could have believed that Christine was not its heroine at all. She rose, without showing any emotion, and offered him her hand. But Raoul's stupefaction was so great that he stood there dumbfounded, without a gesture, without a word. "Well, Monsieur de Chagny," exclaimed Mama Valerius, "don't you know our Christine? Her good genius has sent her back to us." "Mama," the girl broke in promptly, while a deep blush mantled to her eyes, "I thought, Mama, that there was to be no more question of that. You know there is no such thing as the angel of music." "But, child, he gave you lessons for 3 months." "Mama, I have promised to explain everything to you one of these days, and I hope to do so. But you have promised me, until that day, to be silent and to ask me no more questions whatever. Provided that you promised never to leave me again. But have you promised that, Christine?" "Mama, all this cannot interest Monsieur de Chagny." "On the contrary, mademoiselle," said the young man, in a voice which he tried to make firm and brave, but which still trembled, "anything that concerns you interests me to an extent which perhaps you will one day understand. I do not deny that my surprise equals my pleasure at finding you with your adopted mother, and that, after what happened between us yesterday, after what you said and what I was able to guess, I hardly expected to see you here so soon. I should be the first to delight at your return if you were not so bent on preserving a secrecy that may be fatal to you, and I have been your friend too long not to be alarmed with Madame Valerius at a disastrous adventure which will remain dangerous so long as we have not unravelled its threads, and of which you will certainly end by being the victim, Christine." At these words, Mama Valerius tossed about in her bed. "What does this mean?" she cried. "Is Christine in danger?" "Yes, madame," said Raoul courageously, notwithstanding the signs which Christine made to him. "My God!" exclaimed the good, simple old woman, gasping for breath. "You must tell me everything, Christine. Why did you try to reassure me? And what danger is it, Monsieur de Chagny?" "An impostor is abusing her good faith."
"Is the angel of music an impostor?"
"She told you herself that there is no angel of music."
"But then what is it, in heaven's name? You will be the death of me."
"There is a terrible mystery around us, madame, around you, around Christine, a mystery much more to be feared than any number of ghosts or genii." Mama Valerius turned a terrified face to Christine, who had already run to her adopted mother and was holding her in her arms.
"Don't believe him, mummy, don't believe him," she repeated. "Then tell me that you will never leave me again," implored the widow.
Christine was silent, and Raoul resumed. "That is what you must promise, Christine. It is the only thing that can reassure your mother and me. We will undertake not to ask you a single question about the past if you promise us to remain under our protection in future."
"That is an undertaking which I have not asked of you, and a promise which I refuse to make you," said the young girl haughtily. "I am mistress of my own actions, Monsieur de Chagny. You have no right to control them, and I will beg you to desist henceforth."